Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're reassessing the life and legacy of Michael Collins, exploring the lost tombs of Egypt, investigating what really happened during the Battle of Mogadishu in 1993, finding out what the Romans believed about life and death, and then to end the show, we're going to hear about UFOs and what was happening in Ireland in the year 1963. Last week, we explored the life and music of Bizet and discovered how he became an icon after his death. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. But first, we begin with the legend, the life and the legacy of Michael Collins. Michael Collins, The Man and the Revolution is the title of a brilliant new book by Anne Dolan and William Murphy. It's published in hardback by the Collins Press and costs €29.99. And I'm very delighted to welcome the authors to the show tonight. Anne, William, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Patrick.
And can we begin with the celebrity status of Michael Collins in his own lifetime? Because I knew he was famous, but I didn't realise he was quite such a celebrity, even to having racehorses named after him in 1921.
Yeah, whippets as well. He's pretty famous on the whippet racing scene in the north of England, particularly in this time. I think most of us associate celebrity with the sort of post-Liam Neeson period, maybe. But actually, this is one of the, I think, real revelations for myself and Will in the book is the extent to which he was a celebrity in his own time. How much, if you like, the British popular press caught on to him, obsessed about him, wrote about him all the time. The extent to which, I mean, you've got small children in the north of England dressing up as him in fancy dress contests and almost winning. Shows, I think, the extent to which he is a modern celebrity in his own time. And again, I think it really reinforces the whole sense of him as a sort of a very modern figure in that he is, you know, it's possible to photograph him in a way that you can't, you know, other famous Irish figures before this point. He is, if you like, he's on film. He is captured in a variety of different ways that other people, if you like, aren't. And if you like, they can really exploit that sense of celebrity.
And there's a sense or a suggestion that his greatness is tied up in that because he was seen as so extraordinary in his life and in his death and in his afterlife, that perhaps that then creates an aura around him about things that perhaps he doesn't deserve.
Absolutely. I mean, he uses it to his own advantage at times. I mean, he talks at one point about the newspapers and how they're portraying some of his escapes. And he makes fun of this in the sense that, you know, this is nothing as to the three escapes I've had since. You know, he's very aware of his persona, plays up to it, and it works in the sense that it draws attention away from, I think, a lot of other figures in the revolutionary period, if you like. And he takes the spotlight to some degree, oddly, on himself. It does work against him in the sense that I think once you get to the point of the treaty debates, once you get to the split, you're getting some people really holding this against him, that he's taking credit for things that he never did. And you get this very thing thrown in his face in the middle of the treaty debates. It's brought up, the fact that he's going to marry Princess Mary. All this kind of thing is brought up in the treaty debates. So at that point, you can see, if like a balance has tipped, this thing that was quite useful and he used it and exploited it as much as he possibly could in some ways, starts to really sort of turn against him.
Well, I love the approach of the book because it isn't your standard biography. There are thematic chapters. It's beautifully illustrated and loads of documents in it. So you get a feel for the period and what they were doing. Why did you decide to approach the book in that way?
Well, you know, when we thought about doing the book, one of the first questions we really had to face was, why do another Michael Collins book? And the first instance, we thought it was probably worthwhile because it had been 15 years since the last biography, more or less. And we were also aware that a lot of new material had become available in that 15 years, whether it be documentary or visual. And the visual that Anne has just talked about was really important to establishing that sense of celebrity. But the other thing that we wanted to do was not write a standard chronological narrative biography, because there are many of those already. So we quickly established sort of 8 questions that we wanted to tease out for ourselves. In part, they are based on our own interests and expertise, but also in part, they reflect the changing historiography over the last 10 or 15 years, the lots of brilliant work that has been done by other historians about the revolution in general. And we thought we could reflect on these through the lens of Michael Collins. So that's why we settled on sort of 8 themes through from his formation, asking questions like, was he typical of an Irish revolutionary of the period, right through to ideas of commemoration and afterlives, which have become increasingly important in the way we write the history of the Irish Revolution.
And Anne, it's one of the things that was said about him. Arthur Griffith, I think, said it in the treaty debates. He was the man who won the war. And as soon as he died, that was the label that was put on him. But it's probably one that wasn't deserved. It caused a lot of jealousy and resentment. And then it helped contribute to that mythology around him.
Absolutely. And I mean, it does, as you said, it comes up in the treaty debates. And once that the man who won the war phrase is mentioned, it really annoys some of the sort of people like Seamus Robinson, who's there at Solihull Beg, you know, at the very first, if you like, shots of the War of Independence as we conceive it. And he really gets annoyed. He wants to know, you know, did Michael Collins ever fire a shot? And I think in many respects, this is part of the problem of Collins. I think he would have been the first to admit that he didn't have the role in the War of Independence, or the fighting role that many have attributed to him. And I think it's as much about how we want to conceive of that war, if you like, that we reduce it to him. And I think we reduce him to a caricature, and because he had far more parts than that. He's, you know, in a way, he's more interesting to the war because he's Minister for Finance. He's Arms Supplier in Chief, as Union Halpin, I think, calls him, because he's Minister for Finance, which is key to keeping this war going. But I think for many people, and again, it's back to what we were talking about celebrity earlier, the image of him is hugely important to some of the men who are fighting around different parts of the country. He becomes a type of persona for many of them. And I mean, you get these sort of notes to him that are, you know, saying things like, you know, if you're caught, we're done for, you know, you're the most important figure. So in that sense, he's happy to play up to it, but very, very conscious that he isn't this key figure that I think we've made him into. That, I think, says more about our attitude to him than actually him himself, which is the fascinating part of this.
Well, something that I think is very different in this book is the chapter 5 on his ideas, on his beliefs, because we tend to imagine what he would have been like if he had lived and see that the course of Irish history in the 1920s would have been very different. But by going and looking at his writings and his statements and what he believed, you're able to show something a little different.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was very important because so often in discourse, conversations about the course of our country's history since 1922, really, anyone who has any ambition for the country, who has been unhappy with the way the country has gone, has immediately turned to say, well, Michael Collins, if only, you know, Michael would have endorsed my view of the world would be like I would want it. So because of that, we thought it was important to turn back and see what he actually believed in. And in many ways, what we discovered was a very typical Irish romantic nationalist of the period. It was not so easy to kind of create that image to try and uncover the mind of Michael Collins, because he tended to emphasise action and activity rather than reflection and writing. But we could turn to two kind of important books or pamphlets. One was The Path to Freedom, which emerged after his death, a series of articles and speeches really that were written around the treaty period or just after it, and also Arguments for the Treaty, which emerged around the same time. And there, you know, we could see a man who believed rather typical things about Ireland, who, you know, was intent upon the liberation of the Irish national spirit and the achievement of Irish nationality, who believed in all sorts of typical things about the importance of culture and language and history in terms of defining Irishness, who was very similar in many ways to De Valera in terms of, we tend to, you know, sneer somewhat now at De Valera's phrase frugal comfort, but Michael Collins had versions of that phrase too, you know, is slightly more grandiose, but he talked about fair comfort and he talked about moderate luxury being the ambition for the country. You know, again, his ideals very much reflect the sort of Griffith rhetoric around, you know, tillage, protectionism, etc. So it's difficult to see the country travelling down a very different route under Michael Collins than it did under his colleagues of Cumann na Gael, or indeed under Fianna Fáil.
And there are some great stories in the book. I was intrigued by the story of the medium who thought she had made contact with him in 1926, and Horace Plunkett believed her. And it is something about the afterlife, the afterlives of Michael Collins. He continued to fascinate, he continued to exert that influence. He still does. Why is that?
I think it's in ways it's linked to what Will has just said. He suits no matter what point you want to win. He's quite malleable because he dies so young. He leaves the young corpse, if you like. He's a bit like JFK, you know. He fills that sort of role. But I think he's gone through a number of different, I suppose, afterlives. And I think to some degree, with a lot of the books that have been written about him, there's been this urgency to strip all that away and to look at that as being quite frivolous. Whereas I think in many respects, it's really quite important because it's one of the reasons why he stayed with us in that way, as opposed to people like Cathal Brua. You know, you don't get that same urgency or if you like, public engagement in many respects. So the sense in which he can be recreated, he has managed to sort of become the Collins for our times, whatever the times are, is actually fascinating. And it isn't just down to sort of Liam Neeson or that much more recent engagement with him. This has been something that's happened right across the decades in between, because you had huge, if you like, offers of money for his memoirs even before he died. So the consciousness of him as a celebrity in that 1921 into early 22 period, I think, fuels it certainly through the 20s, even into the 30s. It's quite interesting. You get Frank O'Connor trying to get to the real Collins in the 30s already, feeling that so much, if like, nonsense has grown up around him. And then almost again, O'Connor recreates him for another generation. Again, you get the same in the 60s, into the 70s and the 80s and beyond. And in that sense, he's fascinating because I think arguably he does die so young. He doesn't, as Will hinted at earlier, he doesn't live long enough for him to have disappointed us. Therefore, we can make whatever we want of him.
Very good. Well, it's a brilliant new take on Michael Collins. It's called Michael Collins, The Man and the Revolution. Some wonderful documents in it as well, and a very readable and insightful look at the life, legend and legacy of Michael Collins. Published in hardback by the Collins Press. It costs €29.99. The authors are Anne Dolan and William Murphy. And thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Where are the tombs of Alexander the Great and Cleopatra? Both rulers were buried in Egypt, but their tombs have never been found despite years of intensive research and excavation. Yet we have tantalising clues. A new book, Searching for the Lost Tombs of Egypt, describes the quest for these and other great missing tombs. The book is published in hardback by Thames and Hudson and costs £19.95 sterling, so about €23. The author is Christopher Naunton. And Christopher, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hadn't realised that there were so many lost tombs in Egypt, and I hadn't realised that there is this mystery over the tombs of Alexander the Great and Cleopatra, and so many theories, for example, where Cleopatra's is it a mausoleum lost underwater, or is it a secret burial that they're just waiting to be discovered?
Yes, yes. Well, I think we're sort of slightly deceived with the evidence for ancient Egypt in that there's masses and masses of it. And, you know, you can go into so many museums in Egypt, of course, but around the world, where there's just masses of material. Much of it's come from tombs. We know of thousands of tombs, or a lot of them kind of complex, elaborate, beautifully decorated, stuffed full of funerary goods, sarcophagi, coffins, etc., etc. And yet, you know, despite this, it kind of, I think, deceives us into thinking that we must know all the answers. And yet, of course, as with any archaeological situation, what we have represents only a small fraction of what there would have been. So there are these gaps. And I think at the same time, we also know the outline, at least, of Egyptian history very well. So we're blessed in that for the roughly 3,000 years from the first pharaoh of the first dynasty down to the time of the Ptolemies, that line more or less begins with Alexander the Great and ends with Cleopatra the Great. We know who was on the throne of Egypt for most of those three millennia, and we have many of those tombs, and yet, of course, there are gaps. And it just so happens that there are gaps when it comes to some of the best-known characters from the ancient world, and, of course, Alexander the Great and Cleopatra are sort of at the front of the queue there.
And why are people so fascinated by the story, first of all, of the tombs, and then these missing tombs?
I think there is something inherently very compelling and fascinating for people about the idea of a sort of a closed, secret environment like a tomb, sealed up thousands of years ago with the finest works of art and treasure that the ancient world was able to produce. And that, you know, these might be revealed. And we're fortunate to have had some of the greatest stories of archaeological discovery have come from Egypt. The most obvious being Howard Carter's discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun. And I think, you know, that epitomizes this idea of a sort of romantic expedition into the desert, a quest to identify material belonging to somebody who, you know, perhaps we don't know too well. And then, you know, suddenly there's this moment of discovery and a great abundance of glorious material. And I think the tomb of Tutankhamun really is what, in some ways, we've all got in the back of our minds when we're thinking about what might still be out there. And of course, you know, Alexander the Great and Cleopatra, partly thanks to their importance in the ancient world, but also partly thanks to their stories having survived and been told and retold so many times since they were around. They've become some of the great characters, not just from ancient history or for those of us with an interest in archaeology, but they're some of the characters at the center of some of humankind's great stories. So the idea that you could find the tomb of either of these people, the last resting place of these almost mythical individuals who were nonetheless real and, you know, would have had bodies like all of the rest of us, and these bodies would have been placed in these tombs. To be able to perhaps to find those tombs is as close as we can get to coming face to face with them now, I think.
And do you think that there are tombs that will be discovered in the years to come, and that some of these great tombs, their mysteries will finally be revealed?
Well, absolutely no question, I think, that tombs will continue to be discovered. And one of the things that I was very conscious of when I was beginning to put this book together was that discoveries are being made in Egypt all the time. And again, I think from talking to people, there's a sort of sense that there's been so much archaeology done in Egypt now that, you know, it must be all over. You know, it must be nothing left to find now. Surely, you know, with all the modern technology and all the just the years of work that have been undertaken, surely there's nothing left to find. And yet Egypt surprises us continuously. You know, the Ministry of Antiquities these days is really great at forming the public through the press of new discoveries, and on a regular basis, once or twice a month, there's something really, really worthy of note appearing. And a lot of the time, these are previously unknown, undiscovered tombs. So there's certainly going to be tombs to be found. And I think that given there are these gaps, and given how much of Egypt still hasn't been explored, and how much of it is almost impossible to explore with the technology we've got at the moment, and that is particularly relevant when we come to think about Alexander and Cleopatra, because they were almost certainly buried in Alexandria, which was substantially intact. The ancient part of that city, still largely intact, down to the second half of the 19th century. And then suddenly you get an explosion in building, which had the effect of covering the city in modern constructions, much of which is still there. And potentially those modern buildings are concealing ancient remains, which archaeologists never quite got the chance to get to at that point in the later 19th century. And perhaps with new technology, you know, we're going to find that it's possible to see beneath these things, and we're going to find some spectacular stuff, and perhaps those tombs.
And where do you think the great finds will? The Valley of the Kings is always suggested as having further treasures to be revealed.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Alexandria, as I just mentioned, I think is one of the key places. The Valley of the Kings, I think a lot of people probably think is exhausted, and famously one archaeologist explorer in the early 20th century declared that it was, after years of spectacular discoveries. He said there was nothing more to be found. This was a matter of a few years before Carter made his amazing discovery. And in fact, Carter himself at that time was in the process of attempting to excavate every last area of unexplored valley floor. And when he found the tomb of Tut, he hadn't finished that job, and it's never been done. So incredibly, there are still areas of the Valley of the Kings that haven't been explored, and two new tombs have been discovered in the last few years. So Howard Carter's discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb was the 62nd tomb in the valley. We now have 63 and 64, and there are several projects working in the valley still on unexcavated areas, you know, very hopeful that there might be spectacular discoveries still to be made.
Okay, well, Christopher, congratulations on the book. It's called Searching for the Lost Tombs of Egypt. It's published in hardback by Thames and Hudson and costs about €23. The author, Christopher Naunton. And Christopher, thanks a million for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. Last year was the 25th anniversary of the Battle of Mogadishu, and a new book uses recently declassified documents and new interviews with many of the participants to retell the extraordinary story. It's called Day of the Rangers, The Battle of Mogadishu 25 Years On. It's published in hardback by Osprey and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author is Lee Neville. And Lee, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
So can you remind our listeners about the extraordinary events of 1993? What exactly happened?
Well, it was a it began as a humanitarian mission into Somalia. Obviously, there was a civil war, and there was a famine, which was made far worse by that civil war. It was basically the country of Somalia had been taken over by warlords, and there was a UN effort to try and lift the famine and to provide aid to the people. And eventually, the Americans took over the operation because the warlords were actually attacking and killing the UN peacekeepers. Operation Gothic Serpent was launched. So that was the topic of the book, which is about the specific American Special Operations mission to stop the key warlord, if you will.
And it was a mission that was meant to be over within an hour, but they found themselves under heavy fire. The two Black Hawk helicopters were shot down, and then it became this desperate fight for survival.
That's correct. I mean, the actual mission on the day, on the October 3rd, and, well, it ended up being October 3rd, and October 4th, they ended up out there overnight. Was supposed to only be an hour, or less even. They were supposed to just race in, grab the two lieutenants of the warlord, and then get out quickly. And of course, events didn't go quite as planned.
What new insights did you discover from these newly declassified documents and the interviews that you carried out with the participants?
A lot, actually. A lot of, 25 years obviously has allowed both documentation to sort of to catch up, if you will. The Americans, similar to the British, similar to the Australians, declassify material over the years. So I got a lot of background information, particularly on the intelligence side of the operation. So tracking these two lieutenants of the warlord, the way the task force was structured, lots of material on that. What I got from the interviews was fascinating. Basically, a lot of these people had never spoken outside of the army. And 25 years later, lots of them have left the army. Lots of them want to sort of get the real story down, I suppose. Obviously, it had been covered by Mark Bowden in Black Hawk Down, which a lot of your listeners might have seen the film. Mark's book was very good, but it was written only a couple of years after the events. And what the problem that was posed for him was that a lot of the participants were still in the army and thus couldn't talk because of restrictions on secrecy, particularly around Delta Force, which is their sort of tier one special operations unit, similar to the SAS or the Army Ranger Wing or units like that. 25 years later, these guys have left the military. They're older guys, and they're happy to talk. So that stuff was fascinating. It was it put a completely new perspective on events.
And what did you learn that surprised you?
A lot. I guess the key was that the whole thing reinforced just how much the idea of not leaving a man behind, how seriously that is taken. It sounds like a sort of a bit of a flippant phrase, but, you know, these guys live by that. The fact that after the two helicopters were shot down, they had a pilot who was still stuck in the wreckage. Unfortunately, he was killed in the crash, but they couldn't get the body out. So the reason why those guys stayed there for so long, why it became, you know, rather than a one-hour operation, it ended up being a 17-hour operation, was they wanted to get the body of their friend out of the helicopter. So, you know, incredible, what's the word, incredible valor, I suppose. And it's very much a, you know, when you talk to these guys, it's not a, it's not some sort of jingoistic concept. It's very much, you know, it's matter of fact. It's, well, you know, of course we wouldn't leave. We've still got a guy trapped. We've got to bring the body of our buddy home. So that was incredible. The other thing I'd say is that they viewed the danger, which was incredible. I mean, these guys were getting shot at from every direction. And I mean, for 17 hours, they were in combat for 17 hours. It wasn't like, you know, there was a firefight and then, you know, they were sort of sitting around waiting to go home. No, they were actually, you know, in combat. They were treating wounded guys. You know, they were trying to plan to extract all that time. But they speak about it so matter-of-factly. It just really shows the professionalism of the people involved.
What lessons do you think were learned from that time? And was it put into operation then for future military conflicts?
That's a good question. Yes, a huge number of lessons were learned, thankfully. I mean, it's quite often that military organizations, despite what some people may think, they can be quite plodding and dinosaur-like, I guess. They often aren't willing to learn the lessons of the last war. But with Mogadishu, I think because it was mainly special operations units like the Rangers and Delta Force, they actually really went down to the the basics and went through everything that happened. So what we saw was a huge improvement in several areas, really. Number one would be medical. So on the medical side, on the first aid side, Mogadishu really reintroduced the use of tourniquets, which sounds really simple, but tourniquets had fallen out of fashion. There'd been a lot of misinformation, I guess, over the years since the Second World War that, you know, you could lose a limb by leaving the tourniquet on for too long. Mogadishu certainly proved that was incorrect, that they had a very, you know, primary place in combat care. So that was something that's key, that has saved a lot of lives since in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. So on the medical side, that kind of thing, and stuff like there's chest seals now. So when a soldier is shot in the chest, for instance, and gets what they call, which some listeners may know, is a sucking chest wound from sort of the Vietnam films, there is now a particular application you can use to put on that person's wound to help alleviate the damage. So medical was a massive thing. There was also, you know, a huge understanding, you know, afterwards that, hey, maybe the helicopters, we shouldn't have been hanging around over the city for too long, which, you know, arguably 25 years later, you could say that they probably followed, you know, the wrong tactic there. Or maybe they got a little overconfident, which is, you know, always a problem with special operations units. You know, you have success, and then you sort of get a little bit too overconfident. And, you know, that day they didn't realize there were how many RPGs were on the ground, which is the rocket propelled grenade. So they were used to shoot down both helicopters. In actual fact, I think it was four helicopters that were basically made unairworthy during that day. So there was multiple hits. Two helicopters just made it back out rather than crashing in the city. So it could have been far worse. We could have ended up with four helicopters crashing in the city. So it gives you an idea of how much enemy fire was happening. In the book, I speak to one of the pilots, and you know he estimates that there were several hundred RPGs. He said it was like, he likened it to shotgun blasts in the air, that they were flying through shotgun blasts. So just insane stuff. So one of the key lessons from there was that, hey, in an urban environment particularly, you don't want to be flying low over a opposed area for too long. It sounds simple, but, you know, a lot of the tactics developed from counterterrorism training, and certainly that tactic was one of them. So the idea that you'd have helicopters above you to provide support, snipers on board, aerial surveillance, all of this kind of thing. You know, it was certainly a valid tactic for counterterrorism, but then you go into a place like Mogadishu that is awash with weapons, and the question comes that, well, you know, maybe we have to think of other ways of getting in and out of some of these places.
Okay, well, Lee, congratulations on the book. It's called Day of the Rangers, The Battle of Mogadishu 25 Years On. It's published in hardback by Osprey and costs £20 sterling, so about €24. The author, Lee Neville. And Lee, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been very enjoyable.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. In a revealing and entertaining guide to how the Romans confronted their own mortality, Peter Jones shows us that all the problems associated with old age and death that so transfix us today were already dealt with by our ancient ancestors 2,000 years ago. The book is called Memento Mori, What the Romans Can Tell Us About Old Age and Death. It's published in hardback by Atlantic Books and costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. The author is P.V. Jones, Peter Jones. And Peter, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Good evening. Delighted to be here.
Can you tell our listeners what was considered a good death and what was considered a bad death?
Romans were very enthusiastic about a good death because it indicated that they had led a good life. The two were, as it were, coterminous. As a consequence of this, they would expect that a good death would somehow reflect the values of the Roman citizen. And that meant, for example, standing up for everything that a Roman citizen would stand up for: bravery, courage, respect for the laws, all those sorts of things. If you died a cowardly, ugly death, that was not the sort of thing that it meant actually to be a Roman. It was courage and bravery that was the most important thing. For example, I mean, Nero, one of the worst emperors Rome actually had, much loved by the populace because he was an actor. He was a singer. He was an opera performer. He raced chariots. All this popular sort of stuff made the people love him. But the Senate and the politicians regarded him with disgust. I mean, it was rather as if one of our political leaders spent their time mud wrestling and made their fame that way. And Nero, as a consequence of this, met a death which reflected his life. When he found out that he was going to be ejected from the seat of emperor and realized what this actually meant, he fled. Instead of facing up to what was going to happen to him, he fled like a coward. He wound up in a villa belonging to him 3 or 4 miles from Rome. And there, the 3 or 4 followers he had remaining said to him, "Come on, Nero, at least make a good death. Commit suicide. Show that you can do it. This is the brave Roman way." Did he? Did he, Coco? Well, he did eventually. I mean, first of all, he turned to his friends and said, "Oh, look, would one of you commit suicide to show me how to do it, please?" Then somebody gave him a knife and he felt the point and said, "Oh dear, no, I can't do this. This is all too much for me." And then he was told the soldiers were finally knocking on the door. And eventually, with the help of his secretary, he managed to commit suicide. Now, that wasn't the way of a proper Roman. Take someone like Cato the Younger. Here was a man who stood for things. He stood up against Julius Caesar in the civil war in 49 BC between Caesar and Pompey. And he'd gone with those people who resisted Caesar. Caesar defeated Pompey. But he went with those who resisted Caesar to North Africa, where they decided to form a base from which to try and get rid of Caesar. It failed. And when Caesar had defeated Cato's army in North Africa, Cato hadn't actually taken part in the fighting. When Cato heard the news, he summoned his friends for dinner, discussed the nature of the afterlife, discussed who was free and who was a slave. And the point of this was the man who is free makes the right decisions whatever happens. When he heard that the people of the town, which he'd been guarding, had safely managed to get away, he then committed suicide. He took a knife, plunged it into his stomach, fell off his couch. His followers burst into his room to find him this great wound. They said, "Don't be so foolish, Cato. Don't be so silly. You can't do this. We need you." Doctors were brought to stitch it all up. Cato ripped it apart again and died. Now that was the heroic death. He wasn't prepared to be forgiven by Caesar, which he would have regarded as Caesar loved to do, was to forgive people for fighting him. Cato wasn't prepared to do that. That was to show that he was subject to Caesar. He was going to show he wasn't a slave subject to anyone else. He was subject to himself.
There are some wonderful epitaphs in the book, and we get an insight into what the Romans thought about death, that it wasn't necessarily something to be upset about, and some humorous ones as well.
Yes, there are indeed. There's some absolutely splendid ones. My favourite one consists of only three or four words in Latin. It says, "I was not, I was, I am not, I don't care." There were many views of the afterlife in the ancient world. Some people took the view that in the afterlife you might be subject to punishment and torture. Other people took the view that you could go to Elysium, and other people took the view that you really had no idea what happened at all. All you could really do was to celebrate the life you had led, enjoy what you could enjoy, and then accept death, whatever death actually meant. There's a fine epitaph from someone turning the whole thing upside down. "Here I am dead," he said. "I have all a person needs, bones reposing sweetly. I'm not anxious about suddenly being short of food. I don't suffer from arthritis, and I'm not in debt because of being behind in my rent. In fact, my lodgings are permanent and free." Now that's the attitude to take towards it. Many Romans express rather cynically in these epitaphs that it was impossible to know what would actually happen in the afterlife. So there we are. It's happened. That's it. Accept it.
And as the title reminds us, memento mori, remember you die.
Yes, indeed. Remember you die. Remember you're dying. It's I remember a student of mine once translating that as "remember to die." And I thought, yes, I put it in my diary. I put it in a diary, I suppose. But no, it means remember you actually are dying. The philosopher Seneca said, you die every day. And that, in a sense, is true, because you're getting nearer and nearer to death every day. And therefore, you should prepare yourself for it and accept it when it comes.
Okay, well, Peter, congratulations on the book. It's called Memento Mori, What the Romans Can Tell Us About Old Age and Death. It's published in hardback by Atlantic Books and costs £12.99 sterling, so about €15. The author, Peter Jones. And Peter, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
That's a great pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. 1963 in Ireland was a year like no other. Not for any one monumental event, but for an astonishing sequence of occurrences, triumphs and tragedies, joys and sorrows that spanned all 12 months. And it's now been told brilliantly in a new book by Kevin C. Kearns. It's called Ireland 1963, A Year of Marvels, Mysteries, Merriment and Misfortune. It's published in hardback by Gill Books and costs €24.99. And Kevin, you're very welcome to the show.
Inviting me.
Now, we are not going to talk about the visit of JFK to Ireland because I think that has been done to death and there's so much more in the book that is so rich and wonderful. And we might start with UFO sightings because that was one of the mysteries that intrigued me.
Well, I'm an oral and social historian, not a political historian. As you know, 1963 was dominated by political events. So this is not another Kennedy book, not another focus just on JFK. There have been plenty of those, too many. So that's right. I want to focus on the other 352 rather extraordinary days of the year that were never given a due attention, maybe because of the political events. And when you weave them together in a tapestry and look at what occurred in one year, they're quite extraordinary. So I want to shed light on some of these that were either missed, events that were either missed or dismissed. And so as an oral social historian, I set about my task. And the book is filled with events and things that I think a lot of people will know nothing about, or my treatment will open their eyes and they'll think, I never realized the seriousness of some of these.
And as I say, one of them was that mystery, the UFO sightings. How many sightings were there in 1963?
There's three or four around Howth. Of course, that's 1963 was a year across the globe from the United States, of UFO sightings, so it was very much in the news, but certainly not in Ireland. Ireland has to be one of the poorest UFO spotting countries in the world. But there were several that were very, very well documented and very authentic, but they were treated by the press. They were mimicked at first, but then they disappeared. But they should be recorded because they were authentic by very responsible people.
So let's talk about some of the examples of merriment then. There was a bingo craze in Ireland.
There was, which sounds frivolous, but it really wasn't. It started out as few women, you know, would go to a parish hall or something and they'd play a bit of bingo. But it caught on in 1963. When one of the owners of the Apollo Cinema out on Sun Drive Road decided that maybe with the bad weather winter he'd open up his cinema for a night and see if he could get more people. Well, it was a booming success from the start. He, instead of just a dozen or two, he filled the first night, filled over 1,200 people, and so the theater started opening to bingo. And what happened was, it was not only a great thing for the women of the tenements and flats to get out and have what became known as a ladies' night out, which was, of course, was scandalous to the men at the time that the women would be a ladies' night out. They had their seven nights a week. That was fine. But it was one of the early parts of the women's liberation movement in Dublin, because women by the thousands found that they were entitled to go out with a few pals, play a bit of bingo, have some fun, maybe on the way home, stop at a pub, have a half pint, because it's just the period now when the pubs were introducing some lounges and women were welcome. So it really was the ladies' night out at the beginning of it in 63, and little by little women felt that they had certain rights that they didn't realize they had before. The men didn't go for it a bit. The men claimed the women were gambling and immoral and everything else, were so-called bingo gambling. So the bingo craze, and that's what it was, turned out to be quite significant, and rather revolutionary. You know, I'll give you this one. I remember this. I was doing the oral history of a woman on Sean McDermott Street about the bingo craze. She'd had a life of misery in the tenements. And when bingo opened up and she started going, she said to me, and she said this with the greatest seriousness, she said, bingo, it was the greatest creation in the history of mankind. And she was serious. And to her, it was the greatest creation because it got her out. There's one other thing. People won't know about the Great Walk. In 1960, it started with Robert Kennedy in the United States, who was very part of Kennedy's frontier. He was the Attorney General. He wanted to wake Americans up to fitness. So he put on what was a walkathon, a 50-mile walk from Washington to somewhere. It was 50 miles. He was a great physical specimen. And so anyway, it got a lot of publicity, of course, in America, but it got some in Irish papers. So some of the brainstormers at the Evening Herald thought, well, if the Yanks can do that, the Irish can do it, so we'll put one on. So the Evening Herald sponsored a similar fitness. They called it a fitness walk, although they changed it later to the Great Walk. They thought, we'll go out 20 miles to Bray, 20 miles back. We'll have a 40-mile walk. If we get 200 people at first, it'll at least, it'll be fun. It'll be a lark, and it'll get a bit of publicity. Maybe the Irish will think, well, we can start some fitness, too. We can jog. We can walk. So anyway, and they said to the people, whoever showed up, 100, 200, put on Mutt and Jeff outfits, to match the comics in there, and it was to be fun. Well, like the bingo craze had caught on, in over 2 or 3 weeks, it just became the talk of Dublin. It was great. They ended up with over 4,000 people. They were trying to get more ambulances just in case, there were accidents all the way, try to get more guards. So finally it ended up 4,000 people on the Great Walk. In lashing rain, it was pandemonium, but it was joyful pandemonium. And the reporters, who may have mocked it at first, I remember reading one reporter said, oh, they'll not, two-thirds of them will turn back by the time they get to Donnybrook. Well, it was just the opposite. It was a matter of pride, I suppose, because they found out that before the race course, that they didn't have to go individually. They could have teams. So you had teams of men from their office or their factory, teams of women who were friends, and so it was great fun, and it actually worked. It did. It was a start to awareness back in 63, half a century ago, of the Irish, to fitness. Let's get off our couch here, off our sofa. We'll go out, and we'll actually take a vigorous walk. We'll take a good bicycle ride, and so it worked. So the great things like the Great Walk and the bingo craze. In fact, I will tell you, Lolita even showed up, which I liked. It was a spring show, and the film Lolita opened to much controversy down on O'Connell Street. Well, during the spring show, many of the women started wondering where their husbands had gone. They thought, well, they just wandered off to a different part of the show, but they were gone for quite a long time. Well, they ambled down, but they ambled down to O'Connell Street to see this Lolita movie that they had heard so much about. There was a reporter down there covering it, and he said, I've never heard so many country accents in the theater down here. They knew that Lolita was not likely to later be shown in their local village picture house. This was her chance to have Lolita. Then you have other events that got very little attention. There was a racehorse, the racehorse of Europe at the time, called Relco, and winning all the French races, the talk of the race world. And, of course, Irish are among the greatest race people in the world. the horse was going to come over and race in the Irish Derby, and they had 40,000 people at the Curragh who wanted to see this horse. It was being billed as the greatest horse ever to set foot on Irish turf. So it was a huge event. Ralco came out, went through his preliminaries, everything great. He got right up to, it was a magnificent horse. Everybody was just agog looking at it, the specimen of a, got up to entering the gate where the horses were. Half the horses were in 5 seconds before the race started. Ralco, the jockey, leapt out of his saddle, down onto the ground, threw his helmet on the ground and went gesticulating. Nobody knew what was going on. So they had to announce, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, the race is going to be delayed for a few minutes. Then a few minutes went by, then they announced that the withdrawal of Ralco. Well, all the 40,000 people were there to see Ralco. By the end of the day, that evening, Ralco had a mysterious, miraculous recovery. His left rear leg is what caused the problem in the first place. It went lame just as he was ready to start the race. By evening, he wasn't lame anymore. A complete recovery. Everybody, of course, thought it was drugs. There were great drug scandals in Britain at the time. But weeks after that, all the tests were done. It showed no drugs. So then you had this mystery. What happened to Ralco? I go into that story. Or the story of the mystery caller, Father Malachy.
Pretending to be a priest, yes. But Kevin, it's a wonderful year. You brought home, I think, just how extraordinary the year of 1963 was.
All of these items were given some attention in the paper, but they were so easily passed over. And I think the reason was just that following Kennedy's visit and all, and then, of course, the assassination, my God, you know, these stories were so quickly forgotten. There were great threats to the very character of Dublin.
Very good. Well, I'm afraid we're beaten by time, but it is an extraordinary story, and you tell it so well in the book. The book is called Ireland 1963, A Year of Marvels, Mysteries, Merriment and Misfortune. It's published in hardback by Gill Books and costs €24.99. The author is Kevin C. Kearns. And Kevin, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Yes.
Thank you very much as well.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Chris Bent on sound. Next week, we'll be reassessing the legacies of some prominent Irish men and women as we review the new volumes of the Dictionary of Irish Biography. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking History on News Talk.